The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how grammar can get politicians into trouble. How so, Dave?
Well, Rob, this study will be familiar to you if you remember anything from high school English. It has to do with some fairly obscure grammatical rules known as the perfect and the imperfect aspect. So for example, Rob, last week you and I taped the podcast. That taped is known as the perfect aspect because grammarians would say the event was bounded in time. That is that it happened. We taped. Done. End of story. Whereas the imperfect aspect would be something like, last week you and I were taping the podcast. Now this time the event is still in the past, but this whole "we're taping," it's not so much bounded in time anymore. It almost gives the sense that it's still happening.
Dave, isn't it still happening?
It is still happening, but the last week's taping isn't still happening. Now, you may want to ask, what does all this have to do with politics? Well, it turns out a lot of phrases that are used to describe politicians or their actions can have perfect or imperfect aspects in them. And in this study, a team of researchers, to test whether describing a politician with a perfect or imperfect aspect would influence feelings about that politician, specifically feelings about whether that politician was re-electable or not. Researchers took 188 students, and they showed them some phrases about a hypothetical politician named Mark Johnson. And one of these phrases was, last year, Mark was having an affair with his assistant and was taking hush money from a prominent constituent.
That was the imperfect aspect, meaning that he still could be.
Exactly. And other students looked at this sentence. Last year, Mark had an affair with his assistant and took hush money from a prominent constituent.
The perfect aspect. It does sound like it's over and done with.
Exactly. And it turns out that those real subtle changes in the sentence had a very dramatic impact on the readers. More than three quarters of the students who read the imperfect aspect, the was having an affair and was taking hush money, said they were confident that Johnson would not be reelected, whereas only about half who read the perfect aspect felt the same way. And it wasn't just their feelings about whether this hypothetical politician would be reelected. It was also these subtle changes in grammar also affected how much money the students thought he took. The readers that read the imperfect aspect was taking hush money, more than half of them assumed that Johnson had taken more than $100,000, whereas those that read took hush money, the perfect aspect, only about a third of them thought he took an amount that large. So even though these sentences seem very, very similar, there's a lot of subliminal stuff going on in them that can really influence perception about these people.
So is this more a lesson for politicians and political scientists or for the reporters who write about them?
Well, you know, this study didn't really test what the politicians were saying themselves. It was more about what was said about the politicians. So it's really more of a lesson for reporters who write about these people, but also potentially for people who craft attack ads, because you can imagine if you just change the language very subtly, and if you're trying to imply that your opponent is corrupt or having an affair or whatever, just some subtle word changes can make a big difference. But, you know, one expert says that this information could be important to voters as well, because the more informed we are about these manipulations that can be made, the better consumers we are, as it were, of political information, and the better we could tease out exactly what's going on.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from the effect of grammar on politicians to the effect of a father's diet on his children, this next story is about how fat dads can pass down ill effects to their children even before birth.
Through their sperm?
That's the only way to do it. You know, studies have shown, Rob, that if a mother drinks or smokes or does a lot of other bad things during pregnancy, it can really affect the fetus, not only the development of the fetus, but can have harmful effects for the child as it grows throughout life. But in terms of the father's impact on a baby, it sort of ends with the sperm, because the father is not nurturing the child in the womb, obviously. And a lot of these problems with children, you know, can be attributed to environmental factors or genetic factors. This study's about a little bit of both. It's not purely genetic. It's not purely environmental. It's something called epigenetics.
So we're not talking about the environment that the father helps create by smoking around the mother or, after the child is born, having lots of junk food around.
No, this is actually something the father passes down that's not just DNA. When people talk about epigenetics, they talk about these tiny chemical modifications to DNA. They kind of act like volume knobs. So they can, even though you have a gene, these epigenetic modifications can turn the activity of the gene way up or way down or even on or off.
So I imagine this research was not done in people.
It wasn't done in people. It was done in rats. And what the researchers did was they had the suspicion that if a father is obese, a human father is obese, then he can pass down problems linked to obesity like diabetes to his children, even if that's not something that's encoded in his DNA. Again, they're thinking about these epigenetic changes. Maybe a father who eats a lot of hamburgers or a lot more hamburgers than he should has these epigenetic changes happen to the DNA in his sperm. And this sperm, when it comes incorporated into the child, will also have these potentially harmful epigenetic changes. But you're right, really hard to test in people. So what the researchers did in this study was they turned to rats and they fed male rats the equivalent of a junk food diet. They fed them this food that had 40% more fat than their normal food. And as expected, the rats got pretty fat. You can actually see a picture of a fat rat if you want to on the site. And what they did was they mated these fat males to normal weight females. And then they looked at all the offspring. And what they found is, especially among the female offspring, these daughters, these rat daughters, showed a lot of signs that researchers associate with early diabetes. By the time they reached puberty, their insulin levels didn't rise in response to high glucose like you see in diabetics. And they had other problems that the researchers associate with diabetes. They saw some issues in sons as well, but it was mostly in the daughters. Also, the daughters were underweight at birth, and in humans, being underweight at birth has been linked to a lot of other problems later in life, specifically obesity. So they show in this study that even though it's just in rats, merely having an obese father, and this is not a father who was obese because of his genes, this was a father that was obese because he ate this really high-fat diet, was able to pass these negative consequences of obesity down to his offspring.
So we have to stop thinking of all this as genetic.
Exactly. And researchers actually say, you know, it's not just obesity. There's other issues that people think might have epigenetic mechanisms, things like smoking and even exposure to pesticides. We think of these things as only affecting us because we're the ones that are blackening our lungs or potentially giving ourselves cancer by getting exposed to too many pesticides. But the researchers say it's possible that just like obesity, these toxins could be creating epigenetic changes in our DNA that we can pass down to our children.
The epigenetic relationship with women already pretty clear then.
Well, Rob, in this study, the researchers are really focusing on the males because we already know so much about how a mother can influence her fetus, you know, and it's really hard to separate out the genetic factors from the epigenetic factors, from the dietary factors. At least with fathers, you have this really clear stopping point. His contribution ends at the sperm, and the fetus, from a genetic and epigenetic point of view, is on its own from that point on, at least as far as the father's contribution is concerned.
Okay, so last one. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, speaking of conception, this last story is about the conception of what may have been one of the first galaxies in the universe. In fact, this is the oldest and farthest away object astronomers have ever seen. This galaxy is 13.1 billion light years away, which also means it's 13.1 billion years old.
Why hadn't researchers noticed this one before?
Well, Rob, as you can imagine, anything that's that far away is incredibly faint when astronomers do these sky surveys. And this discovery actually came from something called the Wide Field Camera 3 on the Hubble Space Telescope. And what researchers detected was this really faint blip. And they actually detected this a little while ago, but it took them a really long time to measure how far this object was away. And they find that out by looking at something called the redshift. And this is basically looking at the spectrum of light emitted by this galaxy. And from that, they can tell how far away it is. And that's how they got it, the 13.1 billion light year away figure.
Is this observation revealing anything new about our understanding of the origin of the universe?
Well, it's actually confirming something that astronomers had long suspected. Even a few 100,000 years after the Big Bang, when the universe started, there was basically just all these protons and electrons that were starting to get together and form hydrogen. And about 150 million years after this, the first stars and galaxies began to form, but But we can't see those really early stars and galaxies because all this hydrogen that was forming at the time creates this sort of fog in the universe, which prevents us from seeing these really, really early stars and galaxies. But the age of this galaxy suggests it formed about 600 million years after the Big Bang. And that's a period where this fog had started to lift, where there was enough star formation that the stars themselves were actually emitting radiation that was basically splitting this fog up. And so what astronomers can confirm now is that the fog had already lifted by about 600 million years ago. Now, they think if they go back too much farther before that, even though there may be galaxies and stars that formed that early, they're not going to see them because of this fog. So this may be one of the first galaxies to emerge from this cosmic haze.
Suggesting that there may be other galaxies that are around that old.
There could be. And in fact, the astronomers saw other faint objects in these pictures taken by Hubble, but they haven't analyzed all of them yet.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, speaking of astronomy, we've got a story about a very unusual black hole and also a story about scientists who are dancing their PhDs. A few months ago, Science launched its third competition for grad students, postdocs, and professors to act out their PhD theses in dance form. And earlier this week, judges in New York crowned a winner from 45 entries. So you can see all of those videos plus the winner on the site. And on Science Insider, we've got a story about the UK budget. There's some very drastic cuts being implemented, and we'll tell you what the impact will be on science. And also an update on a controversial science prize named after a corrupt dictator. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.